coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
This is Dr. John Hall, congratulating Chris Jordan and the team on the 200th episode of Curious Realm. If you're not watching Curious Realm, you're not informed.
This is Peter Robbins wishing Curious Realm a very happy 200th broadcast.
Hey friends, Anthony Essenplay here from Epic TV, and I just wanted to wish my good friend Christopher Jordan a big congratulations on hitting his 200th episode. Brother, your channel is excellent, and I thank you sincerely from the bottom of my heart for allowing me to be a part of it. I'll see you out there. Take care. God bless.
Brother Christopher Jordan, this is your brother, Reverend Michael Carter. I want to congratulate you on your 200th show. It's been a pleasure working with you, and I want to continue working with you and continuing your ministry. Remember, I said that was your ministry. You're a theologian. So I just want to say continued success and looking forward to seeing you in the future. Take care, brother. You are a national treasure.
Hello, I'm Sev Talk. 200 reasons to expand your mind, 200 reasons to question the world around us, and 200 reasons to stay curious. Congratulations, Curious Realm and Chris, on 200 episodes.
Hi there, Chris. Keith Seelan here. Boy, it seems amazing that time has moved exponentially in terms of the existence of the Curious Realm platform and our friendship. I remember vividly, just recently, our introduction and beginning of our friendship back in Denver, one of the early episodes of the Curious Realm. This is congratulations on 200 episodes. Again, it just seems amazing in the time frame that we're talking about here. Congratulations, Chris, as being a harbinger of reasoned and significant knowledge and information for society at large, in that our society, there is so much more to learn about human beings, who we are, and the universe that we live in. Here's your congratulations for 200 episodes, and I hope that I can congratulate you on 2,000 more as we move down the road. Thanks, Chris, and we will catch up with you soon. Good luck. Bye now.
Hey, Curious Realm, it's your buddy Lyle Blackburn. Me and my pet Bigfoot here want to wish you happy 200th episode. That is an achievement.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to this very special 200th episode of The Curious Realm. Thank you so much to all of our friends who dialed in, said happy 200th, everything else. We would be nothing without our listeners and without our supporters, and of course, without our amazing cadre of guests who come on the show regularly. Also, thank you so much to our good friend, Jason McLean from the Ciru Papers. He is the gentleman who actively did all of the still frame animation cells for our brand new intro that you just saw. Episode 200 here was our intro phenom for that. So I'm very glad to premiere that. We have had that in our dream pocket for a long, long time, and it's great to be able to manifest that. Thank you so much to our friend and guest, Jason McLean, for pinning all of those amazing pieces of artwork for us to have animated and stitched together and make that incredible intro. Our guest in this first segment is our good friend, Nathaniel Gillis. We will be talking about sigil magic, necronautics. It's an interesting concept, the idea that there is magical technology out there, and even the idea that magic itself is a technology, is a very deep and thick concept. Welcome back to the show, Nathaniel Gillis. How are you doing, bud?
Thank you, sir. Congratulations on the 200th episode.
Thank you.
I love you like a brother. You're one of my favorite people in the field, and it's an honor to join you on this immense occasion.
Thank you, man. Same here. You are one of my favorite people just to have off-air conversations with when it comes time to, like, texting back and forth, sharing stuff. And your research is something that has struck a chord with me over the last many years. As you know, I am somebody that is fascinated with the world of exorcism and with the world specifically of demoniac possession and the idea of giving one's will over and the ways that that can go awry, not just in demoniac ways, but also in ways of jinn, egregore, things that we create and manifest in our own lives through our consent. Nathaniel, and the idea that there are entities, I'm not going to even say spirits, because I think spirit denotes the concept that it is disembodied or a representative of something like an elemental spirit. And that's not what this is. These are entities which have been around for millennia now that are stalking humanity and actively using us as almost like a robotic husk by which to not only operate, but to progenerate and create more of them and move forward. How did you come to this realm of research to begin with, man?
Oh, God, I stumbled into it, my friend. It was not my intention to ever come up with necronetics or anything remotely like what I'm doing now. You know, it was only after looking at incubi literature, comparing and contrasting that with the missing fetus syndrome, the Dubuque phenomenon, yeah, I kind of grew out of the dogma and grew into the data. And a lot of that dogma included demonology and aspects therein. I realized that what we were dealing with was a lot more of an embodied practitioner, something that has evolved and mutated with us throughout history. And that this was some kind of species that is, in fact, embodied. And so that led me into the possession literature and the idea that possession to us is pregnancy to them. And then that led me into the UFO abduction phenomenon, which it was just full steam ahead, and it was baptism by fire.
And, you know, you bring up a very interesting concept. Possession to us is pregnancy to them. That is one of the things that when you first mentioned that to me, and just the concept of that, the idea that their possession of somebody is the same as them impregnating somebody and moving forward. That is a big concept to understand. And to get to, because most people, I guess part of the problem that you have, Nathaniel, is the fact that, like we were saying before we hit record, demonology gets swept up in a lot of other studies. It gets obscured with a lot of other, literally occulted with a lot of other studies, you know, to the point that it's obscured and people don't understand that it is. It's different than typical paranormal research. It's different than research into what makes a phantom different than a haunting, you know, things like that. This is research that, like you're saying, goes beyond the point of biblical research. It goes into cultural research in numerous traditions that, yes, is absolutely exhibited in the Bible. But goes into ancient Judaic tradition, goes into ancient Arabic tradition, goes into Vedic traditions, all kinds of traditions across the globe that have these stories and tradition of spirits that are using us as a means by which to procreate and continue a race.
Absolutely. Self-replication of a species. The question is whether or not that species is embodied. And I do believe they are. And that could have happened originally by virtue of possession. And then they replicate through the body they're possessing. But the point is here, yeah, we're dealing with some kind of species. And early demonologists had no real way to quantify it for them. And this is why they titled some of these beings as incubi. And it wasn't just because the entity would impregnate a woman. It was because it would later come back and actually incubate the fetus within the womb. And so that's where the incubate, incubi comes from. Matter of fact, the first painting originally of the incubus was the entity sitting on top of the womb of the experiencer. And so one of the very first arguments that was proposed by demonologists was that whatever these beings are, they were bodiless. They were disembodied. And yet Father Sinistrar of Amino proved their corporeality because these beings were leaving secretions on the bodies of the experiencers themselves. And in addition to the secretions, both Montague Summers and Sinistrar of Amino realized, at least to their knowledge, that whatever the secretions were, it either came from a dead person, a corpse, or from a dying person. And that they were using some kind of death magic or necromancy to replicate their own species. And so that was the kind of vein of thought I was in. And again, I'm groping in the darkness here and realize, like, wait a minute, we may be talking about an entirely new species of practitioner, one that would be more akin to a vampire or a species that is embodied. And the only way it can further its own existence is by creating a fetus as a biological avatar, then possessing it with its own consciousness. And so that's where we have possession and pregnancy coming into play.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting because to bring this to biblical understanding, things like that, which is, of course, mm-hmm. where most people start with demonology, Nathaniel, is the idea of, well, you know, I've got to be Christian in order for demons or anything right. like that. No, not whatsoever. However, mm-hmm. I will say that above all practices out there, there is one that Leviticus and Deuteronomy specifically, and those are like Jewish law books. Those right. are like, this is the letter of the law, follow it. Both of them highly warn against necromancy specifically, mm-hmm. specifically, not like Wicca, you know, like, hey, you know, don't go out and use herbs. Don't go out and mm-hmm. use these things that naturally grow, like none of that. But it's definitely like, you know, don't go out trying to commune with the dead.
Correct. And the data, again, the biggest problem with demonology, I shouldn't say problem, but the biggest setback.
Community was the fact, issue.
Yeah, exactly. Where we had case studies that proved a behavioral pattern or what's called pattern confirming evidence, a data set that was over and over again, is present over and over again. And so when demonologists would go into cases and interface with these demoniacs, they knew what to look for because they knew the pathology of the phenomenon. Now, what's fascinating about this particular passage and even the greater literature of the Bible is that necromancy was mostly defined as communication.
Yes.
Between the dead and the living. That's what was most proposed by T. Whitten Davies and other scholars. And yet there is an area of necromancy, one that kind of props up my theory of necronetics. But this theory and this is very rarely talked about. In this version of necromancy, it wasn't simply communicating with the deceased. It was people performing rituals to implant a new form of consciousness within a corpse to literally revive that avatar with someone else's consciousness to where you would actually implant that into a body that is deceased. And that is a form that's been long forgotten, but it's very much present within my theory of necronetics. But my point before what I just made was that, yeah, in demonology, we had pattern confirming evidence. What we lacked was the scientific method. to prove it empirically and say, listen, here's what the data says, regardless of the dogma, here is what we can back up. And we're starting to have that right now in the field. And it's something that I'm very excited about.
Well, and with that being said, what can you reveal to us? What can you let us know? What kind of confirmations are you guys getting right now?
Well, the first one, again, is that we can't trust everything that claims to be divine or even a deceased ancestor. You know, the cases are ripe with entities that appear and appeal to our kind gentility only to deceive us. And the Catholic Church has known this, which is why they had to revise their qualifications for an apparition, right?
That's right. It's right here in the Roman ritual, like straight up. Yep. It tells you what to guard against and what to look for with somebody who is specifically demonically possessed.
Of course.
And they make the differentiations between that and other situations. Like, hey, you know, make sure to go out and get them mentally checked and all kinds of things, like exhaust to all weather means. But if these things persist, you might be looking at something totally different.
Yes, and it's there are stages of initiation and incarnation with respect to the phenomenon. But, you know, early on in demonology, we had these very rare cases where apports would manifest during and at the end of exorcisms. And however rare they are, these were profoundly haunted events where the demoniac themselves, they're fighting for their own right to exist, their own autonomy, their own free will. And the phenomenon would manifest apports in the room and even out of their own bodies. And they were always small objects, A lot of them were metallic. And so we had those cases and we knew that they existed. We just didn't know why, right? We had ideas. And of course, when you're dealing with people, especially throughout history, you had no real scientific method. There was no way to test them. There was only a way to collect them. And in many cases, just remove them from the home in fear of another diabolical manifestation. Mm. They're working with Steve Mara lately. And I think that he has added a major piece to the puzzle wherein he and Barry Fitzgerald have had cases of apports in homes and the phenomenon would literally materialize them, just like in demonology, just materialize them into homes. And a lot of them didn't belong in the environment. They were taken from someone else's or possibly from wherever the phenomenon originates.
Okay.
And paranormal activity would just amplify 10x. And they've even had cases where a married couple were arguing and one of them sees this figurine moving and they get tired of it. They don't know what's going on. They pick it up, throw it outside of the house. It shatters into 1,000 pieces. They come back in the house. The phenomenon had replaced it right back where it was in the home.
Interesting.
Yes, this is their research.
Now, for those not familiar, what is an apport?
So we've seen apports. So apports are an object that the phenomenon materializes in the environment. Again, we don't really know where they're coming from. There are two leading theories. Number one, that they're getting these objects from another location here in this dimension. Or the objects are actually coming from another dimension where the phenomenon originates.
Okay.
And so we've had cases like that in the Skoll experiment where a newspaper was manifested and it aged. I think it was written in the 16 or the 1930s or something. And it was tested at a laboratory and they believed that the ink had just been printed. The paper had just been printed and yet it was hundreds of years old. So we've had those cases. We've had cases from CERN, right? Where something they would actually create a portal. The phenomenon would apport an object into this dimension. But the question is why, right? What are the underlying mechanics of this phenomenon? There's a difference between knowing it's happening. We've known it's happened. We know it, you know, that they're occurring. We just didn't know why. And so at first blush, the phenomenon would just materialize an object in the environment. And so what Barry and Steve did is, of course, they're brilliant. They said, okay, there's a reason why the phenomenon wants this back into the home. So we're going to run an experiment. So they took the object out of the environment, placed it in a safe place or a storage area, if you will. They wait 24 hours. They get a phone call from the homeowner. Guys, I don't know what you've done, but you've solved the problem. There is no longer any paranormal activity in my home. Thank you for your assistance. And they said, no. The phenomenon's still targeting you. It's just triangulating now.
Yeah.
It's searching for a portal to anchor itself in your environment. And that was when they took the object out of the storage area, took it back into the home, placed it back where it was meant to be, said, all right, let's watch the phenomenon. Sure enough, a day later, the phenomenon, through its triangulation, had targeted and reestablished the connection in that household.
Wow.
So the phenomenon is materializing a port in order to anchor itself within our environment. I would suggest that a lot of implants are ported. I would suggest, even in demonology, that we've witnessed the same thing. Again, not understanding it. We've documented it, right? Even kind of applied and projected our own reasoning behind it. But through these experiments, what we're realizing is that at the end of the exorcism, when the priest is trying to literally displace the phenomenon from that individual,
yeah,
what will they do? I'm getting chills. What will they do? They will apport small objects to replicate the anchor in this dimension. That's a key point. And so what we're looking at now is it's another indication that we're dealing with potentially a unified field theory, where it is the same phenomenon, but it's diversified its intelligence because it does not want us to see the mechanics behind the mask.
And even the idea of ejecting strange objects from the body, that is something that has occurred in cases of possession, things like that, exactly, for years and years. So the idea of that being tied to this, and the idea of, especially the idea of needing a physical entry point. Now, of course, when it's something that we discuss regularly on the show, whether you're out doing CE5 or playing with a Ouija board or anything like that, you have to ask, is it the object of the planchette and the Ouija board that allows the point of entry, as shown in The Exorcist, you know, with the demon possessing Reagan, Captain Howdy? Mm-hmm. Or is it something else, as seen in CE5 and things like that, where groups of people are manifesting something? And I'm not saying that what they're manifesting is bad people, not whatsoever. But we do have to ask, you know, and one of the reasons that I say we have to ask is because one of the first, quote, portal spirits out there, Lamb, like that came from the Almirante workings. The such an odd, trippy word to say. But the idea of this being that came about, and this was before the days of rocketry, things like that. It's really interesting who was there at these workings and who Aleister Crowley had as coven mates. You know, because you're talking about the head of Scientology and the founder of Scientology being there. You're talking about, you know, the head of the people that founded the Goddard Space Institute were there as part of the coven who helped make this working happen, where the goal was to welcome an interdimensional being.
Yes. And even L. Ron Hubbard was Aleister Crowley's scribe.
Yeah.
Now, that's a very important motif, because in ufology, we're seeing the same pattern of behavior here, where it's not enough to experience something. You have to have a scribe, because they're getting downloads and they have to verbalize it. The other person has to write it down.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the same mechanism. And a lot of this, from my perception, is deception. And I say that because there are cases of abductions that I've been looking into where they had the symbols on their bodies have been purposely obfuscated, changed from sigil to symbol, and then the extraterrestrial narrative is pushed. And I'm starting to see that more and more. And I don't know if it's on accident or if this is really done on purpose to hide the fact that some of these beings do not have our best interests in mind. Now, I'm not saying that every experience is malevolent. People will use that, right, that straw man argument to kind of discount what I'm articulating. But what I am saying here is that, yes, some of them are not who they appear to be. And at the end of the day, they do have their own goals regarding our species.
Well, and you know, it's interesting because even the image of Lamb that we are familiar with comes from a series that Aleister Crowley put out called Dead Souls. You know, so the idea that Lamb itself could be one of these souls that you're talking about, and using this technology as an entry point, using these points once again of what are considered to be high magic, almost Solomnic magic, when it comes to things.
Correct. And we are trapped within the three levels of knowledge, the known, the unknown, and the unknowable. And it's possible, again, that when we look at the phenomenology and the way the phenomenon can manifest, we have to go to Bud Hopkins' idea where they asked him, are these beings or are these craft, are they physical or non-physical? And he said, well, they are physical some of the time. And so what appears to be happening is when they are physical, when they are nuts and bolts, we are led to believe that it's some kind of technological advancement. Up until we realize that, wait a minute, it's not just technology, because the phenomenon just dematerialized it within our own world. So it looks to be technology, right? Until the phenomenon says, no, I'm going to take it. And then we're left with nothing, or we're left with what's called a physiological construct. Just the phenomenon replicating portions of our reality.
Yeah.
And it's not real. And so the problem we're having now, even with an abduction literature, is the phenomenon has the ability to control our perception of it.
Yeah.
Possibly the whole time, not just a percentage. And so it goes back to Dr. Carla Turner's theory, where it's like the only reason we know of these encounters is because people are remembering them. And that even then, the memories that they're remembering could also be implanted by the phenomenon. And so at a certain point, it's like, okay, this gets so muddy. Is there anything we can rely on? Yes, we can rely on the scientific method. And but as long as that includes the possibility that we may not be dealing with technology at all, it's something that wants to appear as technological. And then at the time of the phenomenon's choosing, completely transcends all of it. And we're left with like, okay, this is extraterrestrial or something.
well, now granted, I say technology and technological because of the use of sigil.
Yeah.
Because you are using something that you specifically craft for purpose and for specified purpose and individually for specified purpose. Because even within the realm of sigil, you know, you start getting into lesser key, greater key of Solomon, things like that, and start looking at sigils and stuff like that. Go away, light. There we go. Uh-oh. Nope, the light's too bright. There we go. Like, you can kind of see them. I'll bring some up on screen, folks. But the idea of that, that is the starting point.
Oh, it is.
You know, that is like no different than popular mechanics going, okay, here's your basic drawing. From there, you take it yourself, you know, and you bring other elements into that sigil and other things into it that you want to do when you're working. Like that's how that operates, you know. So there is the general means by which to do something, but also the personal path by which you are intending that and using that technology to get out of it what you want.
Absolutely. And there is evidence now that these sigils are being created within biofields and projected upon experiencers, which again points us back to practitioners, not not horns and hooves, but something that is embodied and that is practicing rituals. And what we're witnessing in real time, even in abductions, my friend, that the sigils that are carved into and onto people's skin, they're going through three stages of ritual. Number one, it's the absorbing of these sigils. Number two, it's the activation. And then it's the expulsion. And some of this does follow the philosophy of Osman Spar. And you're exactly right. A lot of these, yeah, I don't know where you want me to go with this, because you know me, I could take off and
rant. Go anywhere so, it's taking okay. you, buddy. Okay. I am so just a springboard.
Okay, brother. Again, dealing with sigilization, which is not a Nathaniel Gillis term. That's an Osman Spar term. But if you had a ufologist that had no background in the occult or esotericism, and they see the strange symbol on a body and they see it underneath the skin moving itself to the surface, they would quantify that as some kind of extraterrestrial symbol, not realizing, though, that it's following, again, the philosophy and stages of sigilization. Now, getting back to early demonology, we have Sinistrar of Amina, and we have different exorcist demonologists throughout history who have encountered this very phenomenon. And what they were seeing is the same thing we're seeing now, is that the sigil itself had created necrosis within the skin it was on. And so there was no bloodletting. There was no blood there.
Yeah.
It was numb to the touch. The tissue itself was almost merging with the sigil. It's crazy stuff, but merging with the sigil. And my fear is that if people do not have that understanding, they don't have that background in the phenomenology, they're going to believe exactly what the phenomenon wants them to. This has nothing to do with a ritual. This isn't occultic. This is not a practitioner. This is just some Pleiadian deity or whatever.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, they'll be like, well, okay, that makes sense. And you know, what's fascinating to me as well is that when you have this physiological connection or anomaly within the skin of the sigil is on or in, it's very much akin to what we found with implants, where the implant itself is some form of technology and it's merging with the skin cells.
Yeah. Yeah, that is opposed to a typical foreign object.
Absolutely.
That is attacked by white cells, things like that, that the cells actively grow with it cooperatively.
Correct.
In a different way.
So, yeah, the body is designed for it, or it's designed for the body.
Yeah.
You know, and let's take it a step further. And this is another case study. People have heard me talk about this. But I'm fascinated by it, and I always go deeper with it. But, you know, Dr. Carla Turner had a case study, and I worked with a family member as well about this, just getting their testimony and kind of picking their brain about it all, as well as answering questions. But where the mother was sleeping in the living room, and they're watching this biofield, this cloud of balls of light moving slowly over her body, and they descends down upon her as she's sleeping. 30 minutes later, an hour later, she wakes up. Her mind says that the interface of these entities, they were alien graves. But the son told me that's very strange, Nathaniel. He said because she was covered from head to toe with sigils. So there is a lot of deception at play. And even to the extent that the sigils themselves went through, here we go again, the three stages of sigilization. And if you get back to, again, the way the sigil is created, I could, if I wanted to interface with you, I could actually program the sigil to give you an image of me.
Sure.
That was not true.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right.
That could totally be part of the magic through which the sigil is being woven. And I brought something up on screen a minute ago, because of course the first thing anybody's going to say is like, same as branding, something like that. You know, you're talking scarification. No. This is not scarification, because once again, the tissue of the sigil is dead. It's not scarified tissue. It's not tissue that's still alive. This is specifically dead tissue. And when you're talking about that, quote, contractual obligation, Nathan.
There we go.
The idea that you have to give some sort of consent to a system unless these rules apply. And some of the rules that apply are being dead. Like any of those spirits can take, and that's one of the reasons why burial was supposed to happen so fast in most cultures. Like it isn't until modern times that it's like, hey, let's wait like 7 days, you know, things like that to bury a body. Most cultures, that is rapid succession. You want that to be done as soon as possible to avoid any kind of cross contamination spiritually.
Absolutely. So, you know, it gets back to the open vessel law in biblical antiquity, which, by the way, was the origin of possession, where if someone had died in the house, they, you know, of course, back in that day, they had to keep all of their food in a like a kind of jars, you know, pottery. And so if someone died and there was a corpse in that house, they were afraid that the smell and the germs and the air would contaminate and pollute the food that they had in those vessels. So they closed all the vessels. And then that evolved into our bodies are the vessels.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah.
And that we too could become possessed. This is crazy. This is what we're talking about, by the consciousness of that entity.
That's right.
And so this gets back into the unclean air and the unclean spirit. Why? Originally, it's because it came from somebody who was deceased. And but my point here again is that, this is some kind of technology. And if we understood that, I think, again, that it would just take 5 minutes to go back, not 5 minutes, perhaps 5 minutes to understand it. Years and years to go back through all of these case studies of abductions. Say, okay, are these sigils, are these just symbols, and are they actually underneath the skin or not? You know, I mean, in demonology, we've had cases where the entity has left claw marks under the skin. And yeah, Steve Mira had just published this on his show, but he sent me a photograph of this too, because his research is kind of mirroring mine and likewise mine his. What we're realizing is, again, that a lot of these images and these sigils are underneath the skin themselves, and they're going through that stage, right? The three stages, and we're capturing them in one of the three. And so, here's the evidence, though. The evidence is that the sigils are the byproduct of ritual. But these individuals are being written into and acted upon, ritualized by another species. And so I do believe that, again, that somewhere in the plethora of possibilities and entities, that Necronetics has discovered an entirely new species of practitioner. And whatever we're dealing with, they're highly evolved, and they have bodies, my friend.
And you know, this brings up a couple of things and a couple of questions. Number one, the idea of being able to control somebody without their and it doesn't necessarily mean that the permission wasn't given, but it wasn't given by that person. And one of the things I want to bring up, a couple here, we had Dr. Megan Rose on about a month or so ago, talking about spirit marriage and the idea of being betrothed to a spirit, and the idea of even being promised at birth to a spirit, as many who follow Haitian voodoo, things like that. That is very much like bruja in Hispanic or Latino culture. That is very much a familial bloodline situation. And frequently it's the fact of, I have promised my second born son to this spirit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things like that. So it may be that somebody along your familial line has promised somebody, and that is just now being contractually achieved. Yes. It could be cases like that, you know, where yes, maybe the person is absolutely a right following Christian, you know, and they go Sunday, Thursday, and Wednesday, you know, but that doesn't mean somewhere else along the line hasn't made that blood oath and hasn't made that contractual obligation to the spirit or to the other side that would allow this to happen to them through the quote sins of the father, as it was once called, you know, the idea that those things pass down through bloodline.
Yes. And the potential exists. The evidence is becoming very clear now, where it's almost like the phenomenon is grooming that bloodline specifically to produce that one individual. Now they have an access to them they would not have had prior to. Let me say it like this. You know, Dr. Gary Nolan has been doing studies and brain scans on the brain. And at first he thought, okay, you know, he's interviewing these experiencers. We found an anomaly on your brain. And they're asking, okay, have you ever experienced a phenomenon? Anything paranormal occurred in your life? And they said, absolutely. And they're like, okay, check, check, check. And so the phenomenon was there were anomalies, I should say. Scarring, sure, maybe too far. But then you go to the second generation. Okay, yeah, we're one generation next. Okay. Have you experienced the phenomenon? Yes. Okay, do you mind if we do some brain scans? Sure. Okay. The same anomaly manifested. Then they go to the third generation. Here's what's scary. The individual claims to have never experienced the phenomenon, but they still have that anomaly on their brain. So it's possible that even the interface events we're encountering as individuals may not be for us. It may be the phenomenon trying to genetically modify our bloodline, hoping that there's a person out there in there that's going to come to the fore, and it's targeting them through a single interface generations before. Targeting them. And I've had cases like that. And, you know, Deborah Moffat has also had that case where the entity, or Prince entity, where it was supporting a spear into the home, demanding a blood sacrifice, a ritual sacrifice, because this individual was promised to it hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And this gets back to this idea that demonologists wrestled with, and honestly, just from my perspective, never really nailed it down.
Mm.
Right? I've said this before, I'm going to say it again. Consciousness does not secrete substances. Ghosts cannot impregnate a womb with a fetus. So it's possible, again, let me explain that, kind of unpack that.
Please,
Senator Avenida Montague Summers, we're collecting semen samples left by these entities. There's no way, right? Again, and that's where I really believe that a lot of these practitioners are disguising themselves as anything but who they really are. And the only way for us to get a good grasp, a good understanding of what we're dealing with, we have to look at the footnotes. They seek to impregnate. There we go. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, this is what immediately pops to mind, is the idea of a homunculus in alchemy. The idea that, like, if you take an ovum and an egg and a few other things and bury it with intent and everything else, that you can now basically make your own creature that you are in control of. And much in the same way as a golem.
Oh,
You are having that creature serve your will.
We're looking at hybridism as it truly is, my friend. Now, let's go to the golem.
Please.
Let's go to the golem.
Please.
The Hebrew word for fetus is golem.
What?
Yes.
What?
And in the golem legend, if you want to call it a legend, what he did was create a form and then implant sigils into it.
Yes. Yeah,
and carbs, then sigils, energy, and clay. Energy merged with matter, and now you have a synthetic entity that is infused with something else, with intention. Whose intention? The practitioner's intention.
That's right.
Now, let's kind of really go into the Ikigai literature. And again, I've never really tied this together for people before, but this is necronetics. This is the foundational understanding of necronetics. In Ikigai literature, here's how we know we're dealing with an embodied practitioner, is because what they did is they took the golem and the homunculus, collapsed them into the same ritual, and now you have an entity that's carving its sigils into the skin of the hybrid mother as they're being impregnated with the golem, the fetus. What were they trying to do? They're trying to self-replicate their species within this avatar. So that's why in possession and pregnancy, they realized that these women were not just pregnant by the entity. That's only one stage. They were pregnant with it. And that was the successful fulfillment of the ritual they were performing.
And that is that's a very interesting concept. The idea that they have impregnated the person with their own consciousness to be rebirthed and spread. That's really, really interesting. And once again, a nefarious workaround.
Yes.
To the problem of having to seduce women or anything like that. Especially the idea of being able to once again carry that through a bloodline, through oath, debt, or anything like that.
Correct. And I want to make a distinction, because Please. A lot of people will have an issue with reincarnation. This is not reincarnation.
No.
This is transmigration. And that's a key point. Transmigration first started out, again, with the Golden Bow, James Frazier, wherein soldiers on the battlefield, even practitioners, if you will, when they were dying, before they would die, they would dispossess their own body and possess someone else.
Yeah.
Now, with respect to what
All
I think
necronetics...
Do what?
The movie All of Me.
There we go. Yes, you're right. It's a biological avatar.
Yeah.
And so it's somebody else's consciousness and somebody else's body. But there comes a moment, again, when old memory merges with new matter, and now you have the biological avatar. So I believe that there are people that are doing this. There's no other reason, again, to have semen secretions on the bodies of the experiencer.
Yeah.
I'll die on that hill. That's not a spirit. Now, these entities, again, are performing rituals on these hybrid mothers. And even in abduction accounts, sometimes we've had to put them on under ultraviolet light to see that the sigils bypass their own awareness of them, my friend. They had no idea they had them on their bodies.
Oh, wow.
So you're actually having people living their lives, right? And suffering from the results of a ritual performed upon them of which they're completely ignorant of.
Wow. Wow. So these are appearing in layers of skin, like subcutaneously.
Correct. Absolutely. And they're sigils. But I just, a lot of this is hard to quantify, because even like practitioners in the occult today, if you were to say, okay, I want you to implant a sigil underneath somebody's skin, there would be no way to do
that. And that's one of the reasons that I popped up the difference in scar tissue earlier, because that's the typical means, is to use a blade or a brand or something like that in order to get the sigil onto skin. But that doesn't kill the tissue, and it doesn't, like, that scar tissue, it's still fully alive,
Correct. And some of these have been burns where, through consent or contact, the ritual is being impressed into them. Now, the scariest aspect of this brand, no pun intended, of research is where you have people that were out of body or were taken out of their body and branded, sigilized in that dimension. And then when they get back into their body, it goes through the series of the ritual. But whatever we're dealing with, again, this is why I differentiate just the average practitioner to whatever these entities are.
Yeah.
They do have bodies because they're secreting semen. They do have sigils because they're practitioners. And yet the dimension and access they have to us, it's scary, brother.
It's different. It's different. And once again, as we say on the show regularly, whether you're talking about aliens or demons or spirits, what have you, they are playing by a different set of rules than at least what we consider ourselves to be bound by. Now, I don't think that a lot of what we consider to be rules are actually binding rules for us. I think they're much more like in the world of Doctor Strange. They're highly, highly, highly considered suggestions.
create it. You're exactly right. Now let's get to the method of suggestion.
Yeah.
Suggestibility the phenomenon employs. So we have cases, again, with that experience, okay, she would have sworn she did. These were alien grays. I was taken by aliens. That's the interface the practitioner chose, right, to appear to her as.
Yeah.
The sigils are what determine the ritual to be. Even the image of the practitioner to her was designed by the sigils that was on her. And so here's what we're experiencing now. This is crazy. But even when that entire scenario has been fabricated by the phenomenon, right? Okay, I believe these are aliens, right?
Sure.
Later on, these experiencers are going through synchronicities where the control mechanism on the part of the phenomenon is reaffirming their interpretation of the interface. Mind you, the interface was wrong. But it's going through synchronicities to say, remember, oh, yeah, you did experience that, and here's why. And then once we get down to the pathology of it, they're having Theban symbols on their body. Now, that doesn't match up. So you have the interface, event, mind environments that are not complementing what we're seeing in and on the flesh. So something's not right. And that's where I'm at with this is, how many of these experiences has the phenomenon manipulated?
Yeah.
And then, reaffirmed their interpretation of it. That was just aliens.
Yeah.
Again, controlling the narrative.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And that I'm sure my audience can hear my rote phrase right now of, I believe that there is a large hominid being known as Sasquatch roaming the woods of North America and beyond. But I think that there is also something else that is fully willing to use the trope of our mind as a point of entrance consent into this realm, because that's what we're out there looking for. That's the experience that we're looking to actively have. If you have invited something, whether or not you see it that night or not, doesn't mean that something else can't use that invite.
No.
Yep. Like you sent the invite out just because somebody got the birthday card at a different address doesn't mean they can't show up to the birthday.
Exactly.
It's like they know where the birthday is now.
Yeah, they're going to come with a bunch of balloons. They're going to give you a gift. You might not like the gift.
Hey, for all you know, that's one of your wife's best friend's cousins, man. You know, I don't know. Fortunately, I don't have that many people coming to my birthday, so it would be immediately suspect if some dude showed up for my birthday. But you would have
snuffed that spirit out of me, right?
But I think the example stands for the fact of you have put that vibration out there. Don't be surprised if something else pulls the string.
Right. Yeah, we become co-creators of a lot of these archetypes, and up to the point where the phenomenon decides to pull the mask off, and now you're like, okay, I don't even know this existed. And the same interface events and deception thereof have been witnessed in demonology, right? Okay, I thought it's my dear Aunt Edna, it's not. Or I thought it's my deceased husband.
Yeah.
It's not. Why wouldn't we believe that just like they deceived us with these interfaces and then ritualized, sigilized people, they would also do it in abductions? And I think that that another thing is that we're not just seeing that occur. We're also seeing them interface as aliens just for them to want altars, which it's destroying a lot of models right now. Because I'm in connection to a Brazilian researcher where they flew in a Pleiadian ambassador. And, they thought they were contacting Pleiadians until the individual whipped out an altar, built an altar right in front of them, pulled out an idol, and then asked them to perform an incantation. Say an incantation to my Pleiadian. What? And at the end result, mind you, is at nighttime, they went outside and captured light phenomena. So I'm of the opinion they're not conjuring the phenomenon. The phenomenon's conjuring them. It's conjuring them through interfaces.
Yeah, it's calling them to that for purpose. Yes.
Right. And there's even evidence that some CE5 practitioners have fallen into that mode where it's not self-initiated. It was initiated by the phenomenon, turning your gaze to where it will incarnate something. Hmm. And now you have, it does appear to have tremendous connections to a species of practitioner. And I'm not ready to label that horns and hooves. Early demonologists were. I'm still reserved on that because I don't think the issue has been settled at all.
Well, and I love the fact that you say you're not willing to take it horns and hooves. Because much like any good researcher, it's the fact of to nail that down to a specific thing, I think narrows a field of research to a point that it almost becomes unresearchable. But not only that, with many, many modern phenomena and the phenomenology of these phenomena being looked at, similarities are being found. And these things are crossing over between the catch-all bins. And it's interesting. And that's why I started this off with the Kleenex analogy, because just science doesn't like Kleenex. They will accept the fact that there are 100 different types of facial tissue out there, from single ply to double ply to lotioned, unlotioned, scented, unscented. Let's talk about that. But they aren't just going to talk about Kleenex, because Kleenex is just a brand name. It's not an actual descriptor. So we've got to be willing to get past that and get to descriptors. And that's what I think you have left the field very, very open for, because I think by saying horns and hooves only, you are really diminutizing the possibilities of what this might be and of what the intelligence is and has been for a long, long time. Now, granted, it may just be once again, the same way science does it, it could just be that religion has myopically looked at this through their own lens only, because that's the only one they understand. Sadly, Nathaniel, you know that as well as I do. You're never going to get the hard religious to separate from the page in order to look at this, And that's something that you really do have to confront head on in this field. And I think that you have done a great, fantastic job of doing so.
Thanks, brother. I'll give you that $20 after the show for saying that. Okay.
I'll send you my PayPal.
Don't worry about it, brother. I got you.
But in all sincerity, it's one of those, like, you've got to be open of mind and you've got to be willing to look at the fact of, hey, just because we understand this in a modern terminology doesn't mean that modern way of looking at it hadn't been the way it has been the whole time.
Absolutely. You're right. There has to be a meeting in the middle. And I think there's room, again, for compromise, at least in the position, because I've never been satisfied with horns and hooves in that most, I guess, dogmatic sense. I think there are questions that need to be answered that do not fit that model.
Yeah.
I mean, for instance, in Genesis 6, to me, that was never a when, that was a how. How did they do this? Mm. Because if that is a win, then they're still doing it today.
That's right.
Because today is also a win, right?
Well, and
they're still doing it.
And if that was an absolute, and we've talked about this before I talk about it regularly. If that was an absolute, if that casting down was so absolute, why is he popping up in heaven talking about Job? Why is he still allowed? Exactly right. Why is he still allowed in the angelic court?
Well, that's a good question. Good question, Hasatan. Right? Okay. What is Satan? What is Satan?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, again, in the Book of Psalms, he was an adversary.
That's right.
You know, if you get into the Divine Counsel of Michael Heiser's work, you see it was kind of set up like a courtroom, right? You have the law, you have the Torah, you have the prosecutor, right? And then you have the defense attorney. And then you have the accuser of the brethren, which is Satan. It's the adversary.
Yeah.
But again, when you're dealing with that model, it's again, and what we're looking at in the field, it's
right.
Oh my goodness. Because even some of the illiteracy we're witnessing is being monetized.
That's right.
And weaponized right. by the phenomenon to where, okay, I even had an individual that came to me recently and said, you know, my, I think it was his cousin had seen a demon. And I said, okay, well, what did it look like? He asked her, she goes, well, it's exactly what you would think a demon looks like. Okay.
Well, that's problematic.
That's exactly right. Because who are you asking that? You know, I could go to India and have a completely different version of that.
Yeah.
Does it mean, right? And so again, a lot of this is problematic because it's programmed to be co-created archetypes, and the phenomenon will use these co-created archetypes as interfaces with us.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah. And I pop lamb up for that exact reason, because it's funny how archetypal lamb is to the traditional gray, you know,
correct.
And the correct. the idea of that, that happened right up around the same time as Roswell and everything else, you know? Mm-hmm. So the workings that brought that about. So the idea that these things are connected, the idea that these things have been happening in connection and in conjunction for millennia, once again, just because a black and white filter has been put on it doesn't mean mm-hmm. that we can't anti-contrast that image and actually start to get some details out of it. You know, that's the example I give people all the time as a video engineer is, you know, what's really funny is an actual black and white TV would be horrible to look at. What makes the image actually viewable is the thousands of shades of gray that you get by turning that contrast knob. But if you turn the contrast all the way up to just black and white, you see very, very little. You get very little detail out of the situation. So looking at something in that polarized way of black and white, it's absolutist. I don't know about that. I don't know about that.
Oh, man.
Like
the
spiritual kernel of that to begin with, I think, is flawed.
Of course, let me take it a step further, and I might be burned at the stake for this, but I don't really care at this point.
You and I both, brother.
Yeah,
let's have a barbecue.
There we go, brother. You know, for the longest time, demonology was dominated by dogma.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that dogma included, do not even research this subject matter. And I've had people who, of course, had zero literacy regarding the subject, but they had the biggest opinion on it. Like Nathaniel, I don't think you should be doing this. It's like, okay, well, what do you think I'm doing, first of all? And they never understood what I was doing. So then it's like, okay, well, no wonder you don't want me to do it. You don't even understand what I'm doing. But they would never recommend. Like, okay, yeah. let's go investigate a haunting. Like, okay, don't even do it. And meanwhile, it wasn't for the purpose of I'm trying to conjure something or anything. No. They would just be like, okay, don't do it at all. If we did not have parapsychology, if we did not have the scientific method, we would not know why demoniacs are replicating apports to anchor the phenomenon in that environment. And so I would propose that a lot of these individuals who are saying, listen, right, don't even go in there and research.
Yeah.
I would say that they're often operating as a voice from the phenomenon itself. because the phenomenon doesn't want to be understood. It does not want to be witnessed. It doesn't want to be quantified. And so, yeah, if we'd have done this kind of research 100 years ago, we would have known what they were doing. Mm. But again, the phenomenon will often speak through the most dogmatic, saying, don't do this. Why? Because it's not because you're wanting to do the best. No, the phenomenon doesn't want us to quantify and document it.
Yeah.
And a lot of these people are working for them, not even realizing it.
Yeah.
And so what I want to make sure people understand is I'm not saying I'm for conjuring. That's not what I'm saying.
Nope.
What I am saying, though, is look, from the scientific method, go in, collect evidence, because you can actually apply that to other case studies and we can get a bigger picture of what's actually going on.
Well, and not only that, from a spiritual point of view, know your enemy.
There we go.
You know, I brought two books to the table today, Nathaniel. The Roman Ritual, mm-hmm. and The Greater and Lesser Key of Solomon. Mm-hmm. You couldn't get more antithetical, but they're both teaching you exact same thing.
Yeah,
both of them, because like the warnings are there. Mm-hmm. And unlike Doctor Strange, everybody, the warnings are at the beginning. Like the warnings begin the book with the Greater Lesser Key of Solomon. And what's funny is, yeah, when you start looking at the history of demonology, things like that, you start looking at things like Malleus Maleficarum, that kind of stuff, which really began a lot of this, at least in the rites of what we know as demonology. And that was mm-hmm. one of those, you need not go look at these things. Take our word for it. You don't need to go read the Goetia because we've read it for you. And here's what it means, you know, actually, if you went and read the Goetia, you would have a great understanding of the difference between a demon and an angel and a spirit and all these things, because they are very, very well defined in there.
They are. And it takes, again, somebody who's willing and people. I hope, again, this is going to be like...
Yeah, I'm not saying go draw sigils on the ground.
No.
I'm saying understand that words don't hurt you. Words can't hurt you. Yep. Even reading them isn't going to open the portal.
I don't believe that's the case either, right? You know, and again, this is a lot of the dogma that we have to sit through. Again, there are good people that have bad dogma. So mm-hmm. I separate that from them as well.
Same.
But in order for the next generation to have a proper understanding of what's going on and not just, okay. Again, here's why. Because a lot of dogma is wrong.
Yeah.
A lot of the phenomenon manipulate dogma into communication. And so that's why we have to sit again with a question and say, okay, objectively speaking, what about the dogma has been proven by the data? What about the dogma has been disproven by the data? And if that's the case, are we going to be intellectually honest enough to identify it? If not, don't have an opinion on the matter, right?
Yeah.
don't even have the conversation, because you're coming at it in bad faith. And I think that we're starting to, I don't know if I'll call them answers, but we're starting to ask the right questions at least.
Yeah. And you've got to come to the table of debate with the spirit of debate, not with a wall of dogma, you know, and as much as I hate saying it, yes, much of it comes down to spiritual debate, people. It comes down to, sadly, what the Council of Nicaea spent so long arguing about, things like how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. But it's through thought experiments like that. And open-minded thought experiments, you know, where it's mm-hmm. you're putting down the idea that a sigil is technology, and how can that be technologically hacked, and how does that change the rules of the way this operates, you know, and the way in which, and we aren't denying what the traditional dogma is saying. We're actually adding accoutrement to it. And fine-tuning the dogma. It's not against the dogma whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Actually fully within it.
You're exactly right, because initially the dogma was designed to confirm the data.
That's right.
It's the data that informed the dogma, not the dogma informing the data.
Yeah.
And with that said, I'm going to go to another theory that I'm proposing.
Please.
Is that in these cases of sigilization, that the practitioner is projecting the image it wants to be seen as into the sigil, and that the sigil is on the skin before the interface event begins. It's helping construct that interface event. And then afterwards, right, okay, I'm abducted. So a lot of this, again, this is new research. Yep. Ian, I don't know where it's going to go. But the point stands that whatever we're dealing with, they do seem to be a species of practitioner. People are going to hear that, and they're going to hop on, right, horns and hoofs train. But there's a fine line.
Yes.
And it gets back to the Genesis 6 thing. Okay, like if they fell then through what they're doing now, would they be falling now then? Right?
Yeah.
And that's the problem.
Yeah.
Oh,
well, and that's just it. You know, is it a continual fall? How does that work? And
that's
once
my
again,
point, right?
even bringing up the It's really beautiful, the work that you have put together, Nathaniel, and the way that you have coalesced these things from varying fields and over a great, great expanse of time to coalesce a thought like this. And there's a reason why you're working with the people that you are, because the idea of this being a technology, and specifically a technology. Once again, I love necronetics. It's a beautiful term because it really does bring about the idea of full control of the dead, the dying, those that are in the midst of crossover, you know, and how those worlds can come together in that kind of way. So, yeah. Amazing stuff,
man.
Thank
you, brother.
Amazing.
Appreciate it, buddy. Thank you.
You have started some exciting stuff that I want to promo here at the end of this. Tell us a little bit about Parasymposia. You're still getting the website up. You're still getting legs underneath it and full supports, but I am completely behind this. I'm excited to say that you'll be part of Curious Research and one of our research fellows. But tell us a little bit about Parasymposia and what this concept is all about, man.
So for the last, I would say, 6 or 7 years doing interviews, lectures, people just wanted me to do my own thing, you know, and there's parts of the research that I can't put out on YouTube that I can only just put out on my own platform. And so I've created Parasymposia. It's going to be surrounding my research on necronetics. You can do the free thing. You can do the membership, which will even get you more access. But right there, as you see it, there it says the get early access to Parasymposia. You can put your email in there. It doesn't mean you're signing up for anything. You're just signing up to get access to the website and everything. And then if you want to be a member, you can. But yeah, I'm going to be including myself and other researchers. And of course, like I said, it's going to be surrounding necronetics, the self-replication of species, and my research as a whole. But yeah, sign up for early access, and you'll get to see where I'm at in necronetics. So I appreciate it, brother. I'm excited.
I am more than excited for you, man, because once again, I think that this is something that will jump to the front of numerous fields of research. I think a lot of things are starting to point this direction, and especially point to the direction of intelligent controls from other side. So it's fascinating and amazing. And like we say before the show and on it regularly, as we discuss this, scary as hell. Scary as hell.
It's really one of the few things
that it's like, I'm actively disturbed by only a few things that I discuss on this show, Nathaniel. but when it comes to this, and specifically the nefarious loopholes being usurped and used within the spiritual system, it's pretty phenomenal. I mean, there's a reason why attorney comes from that low down, low down point of view and terminology because they are a vocal advocate for the other. So, it'll be interesting to see where this work comes in the next year or so, man. I'm so happy for you. It's great.
Thank you, brother. And congratulations again. 200 shows. It's incredible.
Thank you.
Like I said, you're a treasure in the field. I'm glad to be friends with you, sir.
You have been one of the many guests that has been around since the days of Dudes and Beer.
Oh my God, I forgot about that.
You've been around far longer than 200 episodes, buddy.
God, that was a long time ago.
Absolutely, exactly. So I want to thank you for always coming on and openly and open-mindedly and open-heartedly sharing your research and what all of this is about. Thank you so much. Hold the line real quick while we close things out and throw to the next segment. While you were online checking out everything from Nathaniel Gillis over at Parasymposia, I just signed up, everybody. You should go sign up so that you have early access. While you're online checking that out, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can go to the store and find not only all the books and classes and movies and everything by our guests, but also your link to Curious Research into the Field Observation and Encounter Log. If you are a researcher in the world of paranormal, UFOs, or cryptids, that is your back pocket log to write your data down in the field as it happens. When we come back from this quick commercial break, we will be joined by our good friend and guest, Dr. John Hall. We will be talking about targeted individuals, targeting technologies, as well as the all new AHI protocol with the military for anomalous injuries. So we'll be getting into that and what hope that may hold for families of those who were targeted right after this, folks.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the Field Observation and Encounter Log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick break. Thank you so much for staying around. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you are a user of CBD products like I am, stop on by TrueHempScience.com today. Christopher Lynch and True Hemp Science make some amazing CBD products using a spigyric process. Every part of the plant, stems, seeds, buds, leaves, roots, every part is used, combusted, reused, and that process followed time and time again until nothing remains, providing an amazing spigyric product, complete with terpene profiles and all. Stop on by and check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get two, count them, two edibles on your way out the door. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Dr. John Hall. We will be talking about targeting technologies, some of the latest in targeting news. There's all kinds of stuff coming out. We were just talking just a minute ago. Good doctor, welcome back to the show. We were just talking.
Hey, Chris, great to be back on. It's been a little while.
It's been a long time, you know, too long for my opinion. But things have been crazy in both of our worlds. So I'm glad to see things settling down a little bit for you. And also glad to see some of these things happening in the world of targeting and targeting health news, things like that, especially the recent addition of anomalous health incidents to TRICARE, which is one of the government military healthcare websites for family members, things like that. So the idea that they have added the diagnosis of anomalous health incidents, which is pretty much the casual way of saying immaculate concussion. So when did this first hit the wires, doctor? When did this first hit TRICARE and other healthcare websites like that?
They were talking about it in 2024, and I've been kind of keeping an eye on it. We talked about it before, and we'll talk about it today. But when the diagnostic criteria came out through the Defense Health Agency, Article 244 came out, which is basically a manuscript on how to diagnose AHI, and it tells you that if you're a military member and you experience these particular symptoms, it may be anomalous health incident, report it to your superior, and then they'll put you into the right categories and in front of the right people to evaluate you. And in the form 244, it actually goes through, it's 30 or 40 pages, and it actually goes through exactly what your primary care is supposed to go through as far as examining you, a bunch of vestibular testing, oculomotor testing, psychological testing. And eventually, if you score high enough on this screening tool, then you're referred over to the Intrepid Center, which is the Center of Excellence for Traumatic Brain Injury, and looked at for what we call non-kinetic TBI, you know, meaning that you weren't hit in the head with a projectile, but you're showing symptoms of traumatic brain injury. But interestingly enough, in early 2025, it was added to the TRICARE. For those of your listeners or your watchers that don't know what TRICARE is, TRICARE is what you get if you're retired military or if you're a military dependent. So technically, TRICARE is civilian health insurance for the most part, and which is good because we're hoping we can kind of tail in some of the targeted individual complaints into that. And there's probably a fair share of targeted individuals, civilians, that are being hit with directed energy and Havana syndrome, that we might be able to, you know, maybe sneak through some evaluations through TRICARE, which would be really cool.
Well, and you know, the fact that we got to sneak in a diagnosis is kind of horrifying to begin with. However, the fact that they have now at least put forth means by which to report, I think, is a huge step forward. And also, much like, I know a lot of people don't like Arrow and all that kind of stuff that came out with the UFO UAP community and things like that. But the one thing I have held is at least now they are trying to make a unified reporting system. At least now they're trying to make a way by which people who fly multi-million dollar platforms for the military can make a report of something that is dangerous to them and their job duty, and not worry about losing their job. You know?
Yeah, and that's kind of, and I'm hoping for the best, but what I'm hoping this isn't going to be is a fast track to a psychiatric evaluation, you know, where they basically tell you it's all in your head. Now, that's kind of what they've done with the current Havana syndrome victims that, sure, you know, were diplomats and State Department officials. And, you know, there were people from Cuba, from China, from Vietnam that were there when Kamala Harris was in Vietnam. She had staff members that came back, voicing Havana syndrome complaints. But so far, the government hasn't really gave those folks a fair shake. I think they would agree with that. You know, some of them that I've spoken to, but at least now there seems to be a way to kind of open this up to civilians. Because, I mean, there's been multiple, you know, physicians in the civilian world that have tried to reach out to some of the doctors from the CIA, from the NSA, from the military that have worked with some of these Havana syndrome people saying, you know, we've been fighting this in the civilian world for 20 years. This isn't anything new to us. You know, maybe we should combine forces and, you know, and see, are you seeing what we're seeing? Are you seeing basically this kind of all start with tinnitus, you know, or are your victims hearing voices? Or are they really just hearing, you know, the screeching or what sounds like crickets? Because I can tell you some of those victims that reached out to me were hearing the voices of the people surveilling them. They weren't just hearing what sounded like tinnitus.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting the symptomology that goes into things, especially the cricket sound, specifically the idea of the ultrasonic receivers and transmitters being used specifically to trigger devices. But when they're in proximity of each other, things like that. That was one of the things, I guess it was on The Proof Is Out There, that when they were talking about the cricket sound, that may have been one of the points of generation of that, was the fact of using ultrasonic transducers, things like that. And yeah, you know, it's a common way to trigger things like that. That's how we trigger garage doors to open and close, all kinds of stuff. So if you have them in proximity of it, now the question you have to ask is, what the heck are those sensors doing in an average room? You know, because they wouldn't necessarily be in an average room, especially in the quantity in which, to interfere with each other in such a way. You know, if they are, then, well, obviously the room is being bugged or surveilled or has some sort of other technology going on in it to begin with.
Well, and the other thing is that it seems to carry over, you know, with when the person leaves that particular hotel room or that apartment.
Yep.
You know, most of these Havana syndrome victims are still being victimized. You know, that you don't see too much about in the press. But in the couple of interviews that I've seen, and the handful of people that have, through secondary, you know, people reached out to me, mostly because most of them are still under gag order for the most part. So, you know, the only way I hear from them usually is through a family member that says, I wanted to reach out to you because I've got an aunt or I've got an uncle,
yeah,
you know, that was one of the Havana syndrome people, and they're curious. You know, none of the people actually doing the research reached out to any of us that have been involved in it in the civilian world. But, you know, like I've told you before, you know, on camera, I guess, and off camera, is that according to some of the CIA physicians that did the research, they know exactly how it's being done. So, you know, what you read in the press that there's still no certain, you know, known factor that's the causative agent for Havana syndrome, I think is probably somewhat dishonest. I think they do know. Now, they have finally said, well, we don't think it's coming from another country, that somebody that's trying to target it, which I had told you on your show when it first happened. You know, yeah. when Havana syndrome first broke, you know, I was on with you and I was on with Clyde.
Yep.
And said, you know, they're trying to say this is coming from Russia and that it's an acoustic weapon. And I went, it probably isn't coming from Russia, and it's absolutely not an acoustic weapon.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, but it's, I guess I don't know if they're actually trying to break it loose into the public through going through TRICARE and making it a little more civilian friendly, or if this is all, you know, part of a game to normalize it, you know, maybe. And that's kind of the sad part where we're at. It would help a lot if the people doing the research in the government sector would partner up with those of us doing the research in the civilian sector, you know, because I think we could, you know, we could come to an end with how it's being done and why it's being done and help some people. But if the truth is that they know exactly how it's being done and they're still refusing to work with us, you know, that's kind of another dead end for us.
Well,
but as we were talking earlier, the only way, I think the best way to get our civilian victims at least getting the same care and the same diagnostics is to follow that DHA 244 form, run them through all the same testing that they're doing the government testing with, and kind of have a parallel track of research.
Well, and you know, this is where Curious Research has been for the last year and a half since I founded it, Doctor, is the idea of bridging the world of, and the only, I don't even like using the term paranormal with this. I don't. Sadly, it's shoved into that catch-all bin, much like UFO, UAP, things like that. And science doesn't like looking at that. And we have to pull it out of that. We have to separate it from that. And even community-wise, folks. And this is hugely, hugely important. And I cannot stress this enough. When you want to get science involved, when you want to get the government involved, things like that, which we have to get science involved, we have to get the government involved. That means that we have to be willing to put aside certain thought forms, at least for now. If they do not align with a unified goal of what we are trying to diagnose and what we are trying to get through, and the legislation that we're trying to get pushed through for regulations on this, anything like that, then you've got to have a laser focus. If you put it into the world of paranormal, if you tie the paranormal to it, because believe me, like I would love to have Roger Stankfield on to talk more about and connect him with people like you, because his work has been in the world of Havana syndrome and its possible connection to UFO and UAP encounter, you know. And I have said since the very beginning that when you are exposed to frequencies like this, when you're exposed to technology like this, as well as UFO, UAP, something changes. You know, there is a actual physical change that occurs. Go ahead.
Well, and they've actually taken people with UAP and UFO exposure, and they display the same brain symptoms and the brain pathology on diffusion tensor imaging as the people with Havana syndrome.
Yeah, exactly. And the idea of, where is the fusion tincture imaging? I just had that up. There it is. And when you're talking about mapping the brain function in that kind of way, that is a great way to, and granted, this is an extreme technology. It's not something that is commonly available. It's not something that you can just like, it's not like an open MRI, you know, where they're just about in every town now. You know, so being able to get somebody under this kind of treatment, under this kind of observation is hard. But I think it's also an important step to be able to get to where we have a baseline, you know, and until we can create a scientific baseline for such things, then it's hard for us to move forward scientifically. And that's what we have to do. And we have to be willing to do that, because until we have a hard definition, it's going to be hard for us to make any kind of law that regulates, because you got to have what you're regulating, you know?
And, you know, it's funny that you mentioned about the diffusion sensor imaging. For about a year now, I've said that, you know, if we start a registry of civilian victims of Havana syndrome, that would probably be the route that I would want to go, would be to get them all in for DTI. testing, because that's at the University of Pennsylvania. Ultimately, the way they came up with their diagnosis and their claim that this was all being done probably by directed energy, specifically microwave-based weapons, was by showing white matter tract damage on diffusion sensor imaging. I don't remember if any of their research specifically said they did DTI to diagnose that, but the only way to diagnose white tract damage is DTI. So it had to have been what they did. We were talking about earlier, you know, off camera, you know, there is a group now that's actually trying to get a registry together.
Yep.
Of civilian victims of Havana syndrome or AHI through Targeted Justice and a Dr. Lynn Baer, which I'm glad to see it. I think is really on the right track with that, because like you brilliantly said, we have to meet science for sciences. It's not going to happen the other way around.
That's right. They are going to come meet us and don't get me wrong, science is all about a wild hypothesis, all right? Like, hey, once you've observed and you have a question, you can hypothesize anything once you've gathered a little bit of data, you know. However, what they want is a way by which to categorize things. And we've got to be able to categorize it. If we can't categorize it, then we can't separate the diagnosis between that, between even, let's say the non-traumatic or the traumatic brain injury or the anomalous health incident and what we now know as electromagnetic hypersensitivity. If you watched the show Better Call Saul, Saul's brother is an EHS sufferer, and this is an actual thing. There are people who are physically affected by electromagnetic fields of certain intensities. So, like, there are people who get headaches when they are around Wi-Fi generators, Wi-Fi repeaters, things like that. So, even being that is a diagnosis and something that is very new. Only 2020 it shows right there. So this is just out there medically and something that, you know, most doctors would not know about. Most psychiatrists would not know about. They would have to deep dig into your symptomology and into reference to be able to find this stuff. But it's out there, you know, but we've got to be able to separate and collate the cases between EHS and AHI, you know, the anomalous health incident, the immaculate concussion, so to speak.
Well, and that's why I think the term non-kinetic TBI is probably the best way to describe it. Because like I said, it's not happening from a hammer to the head, but it is happening from a waveform to the head. So, but man, if we can get these people together and actually get, positive findings through DTI, at least that puts some data on the table that we can go to some of these intelligence agencies and some of these researchers that have worked with Havana syndrome and say, you know, we've been putting up with these complaints in the private sector now for at least 20 years. Mm. And, you know, here are the same findings that you found with UAP exposure, with Havana syndrome, and probably, you know, similar if you looked at brains on people who are working around radar stations or, you know, high power lines, you might find the same thing. I know that they did have controls. Yeah. Yeah. I know they did have controls to their studies at UPenn. And that was some of the complaints of some of the smaller studies is they said, well, you know, your control should be something similar. You know, if you're looking for damage from, you know, high power electromagnetics, then your control needs to be somebody that works in a field that maybe is around that same thing.
Yeah.
So that was one of the complaints with the study is that their controls weren't right. But, you know, white tract damage is white tract damage, you know, and it's pretty easily seen on a diffusion tensor scan. So I think bitching about the control probably was a way out of it. Because, you know, when all of that came out and they said, this looks like microwave energy, you know, well, James Giardino and Dr. Lin and all the experts who actually did microwave research for years had said, oh, you can't hone down a microwave weapon to actually cause harm to a person without frying them. They would be on fire. They would be burning. You know, you can't get it to a human being without burning them. And we all knew that wasn't true because we had already been seeing it used in the civilian sector. Well, now these experts are, as soon as it came out that it was government workers with Havana syndrome and exposed to microwave energy. Well, now all of a sudden, you know, they're saying, well, maybe there's a way. And I mean,
well,
I don't know.
You know, man, once, and he's a person that I've been wanting to try to get on. I am cursorily connected with him, but the actual front director for Russia, for the CIA, who was one of the people that was one of them that really rang their bell, where they're like, holy crap. This is somebody that was a CIA sector chief in the area. Like, intelligence depends on him. Weapon strikes depend on him. Like, there's a lot of things that come down the pipeline through an intelligence source like that. So that intelligence source has to be impeccable. You can't have them suffering a biweekly migraine and hearing things and giving you intelligence at the same time, you know? So when people of that rank and file start getting hit, as opposed to somebody's wife who is in the hotel room a lot more than him, you know?
I don't know if we're talking about the same guy, but I know one of the CIA guys that was actually a Havana syndrome victim. Was really not too happy with the response he got from the government, you know, either on his treatment. But I still think he's still of the thought that, you know, it's a foreign actor that was doing it and not his own organization.
Yeah.
Which I think he's wrong. Straight out, I think he's wrong. So,
well, and let's start exploring that real quick, Doctor, because that's where a lot of people unfortunately get lost. That's where a lot of people, because what is the vested interest at that point? Of targeting somebody, even if that person is getting accidentally swathed because they live in an apartment nearby or something like that. How does somebody become targeted to begin with? And what are the means by which they can do that via distance without physical connection, because there's a lot of talk out there about implants. And you've definitely found your fair share of implants in people, you know. I know Dr. Duncan found his, but that is not the great majority of cases, and that's not any of the cases that involve Havana syndrome.
They haven't even looked for implants. You know, that's what I was
I said that's very interesting that they have not scanned for implantation.
No, that's not even part of the workup. Frequency scanning is not even part of the suggested workup. Not even after you get to the Intrepid Center for Traumatic Brain Injury. They'll MRI you and they'll deep and do diffusion tensor imaging, but they're not doing frequency scans or anything that looks for any type of implant. So I think it probably started multifactorial with, you know, people doing it with implants and, you know, with, you know, just, you know, attacking you with energy. I mean, I think there's ways to probably track you without an implant now. Matter of fact, I know there is, but I know we started with frequency scanning, hoping that the easy way out was going to be we found a bunch of implants in people and you remove them and the targeting goes away.
Yeah.
But, you know, here we are 20 years later and we're still talking about it and it hasn't gone away. You know, so, I mean, personally, I think there's probably some people that are still being targeted. Now, the thing now is, you know, when, you know, we were finding Vera chips and things like that in people that it traced back to the NSA, and we did, then that's one thing, and it's easy to find. Well, then when it became to where you couldn't find something on X-ray or CT or MRI, well, then it must be nano, because then nano became the factor. And have people had, you know, nanobots and nanotechnology removed from them? Yes, they have. I'm actually working as an expert in a case, you know, against the Navy right now, that's just that. But again, if it's nano, that, you know, you don't have to be injected with that. That can be done to you through what you breathe, through what you eat. You can get that into a lot of people. So then you got to think, well, even though there's a couple of 100,000 people voicing, you know, targeted symptoms and electronic harassment, man, if it was through food or through our air or, you know, through what we're breathing, you know, you would think that that would be several million, not a couple of 100,000, you know, people, and it's not. So, you know, that's why when smart dust became a thing, I thought, you know, if this is something we're all breathing, you know, we should be seeing a higher incidence of it.
That is really creepy that I literally brought that up right as you said that.
Oh, yeah. It's our hive mind.
It is. But the idea that smart dust is out there, these things have been out there. I was just bringing up the biomechanical capacitor that's been come up with for implants, so that, like, you don't have to replace batteries in something. It will be powered forever by your bioelectric signal. Things like that. And don't get me wrong, folks, like, yes, Neuralink is out there, but good God, the means by which you have to go through for a Neuralink. The ways that you can pick up somebody else's brain, though, and even the fact that they have telekinetically connected brains in the lab, takes things to a different point, though. You know, and when you're talking about technologies, like I've, as you were talking a minute ago, I pulled down my speaker like I normally do. This is a spotlight speaker. You can see here, there's like a nice little array inside of, ultra high frequency, transducers in there. That will vibrate your skull and put a message into it. And I can do it up to about couple hundred feet away with this one. But you don't have to have all of that technology. There are other means by which to do that. There are lasers by which to do that. There are radio means by which you can do the same thing. So the idea of, once again, it moving from an acoustic weapon, as was thought for a long, long time, you know, the idea of something along the lines of like a repurposed LRAD almost.
Well, you know, there was a time in both of our lives where, you know, you could go someplace where there was no cell signal, yeah, and there was no electricity, and there was no telephone, and there was no TV. And when a lot of this started, the initial research that I did is we took groups of targeted individuals and we took them out to a ranch with no electricity, no power lines, no cell service, and they were still attacked and they still heard their attackers.
Yeah.
We took them out on a boat in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico, about 20 or 30 miles out, where there was no cell service, you know, no electricity, and they still heard voices and still, you know, claimed, you know, to feel attack. So, you know, we kind of came to the conclusion too. Now, the one place that, you know, you could take people to was down a mine shaft 300 or 400 feet. And a couple of people we did do that with in Colorado, and through ISA Act, we did put people in a anechoic chamber, a research grade anechoic chamber, and their symptoms seemed to stop when they were in there. And we did pick up signals that were coming from those people within the chamber, but nothing was getting in. So they were subjectively better when they were in there. So the delivery system, that's why at the time, you know, I mean, the delivery system to us seemed to be satellite based. because there was truly no escaping it. And there was no escaping it 20 years ago. There's certainly no escaping it now.
Yeah. Yeah. And once again, the idea of this being so closely associated to other medical conditions like the electromagnetic hypersensitivity, you know, stuff like that, that is only recently, once again, hit diagnosis because not until, and when you think about these things, especially scientifically, study-wise, stuff like that, like you, it takes a good 10 years to get a good proper study done medically, you know, anything like that. Some of them are forced through. Some of them have things done a little bit more rapidly. But if you're doing a long-term medical study, a study of effects and side effects of something, yeah, you normally want a good 10-year long track. You want to be able to mice it up and see what happens to the babies of mice and things like that, generational studies, that kind of stuff. And even when you're talking the effects of electromagnetic radiation, it took a long time for even the cell phone industry to say, and a little bit of arm twisting to be like, eh, well, yeah, maybe there's a little bit of damage that's done through regular and intense cell phone usage, you know.
Well, yeah, and the reason for that is there were plenty of studies that showed that there was some danger, especially if you have a cell phone next to your head or in your pocket next to your testes.
Yeah, next to your genitalia.
But you know, all of the studies that said it was safe were sponsored by cell phone companies.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know. Much like all of the whenever Sanjay Gupta left the World Health Organization and found all of the studies on marijuana and its actual uses. And he was like, my God, where have all these been? Like, none of these have been provided to me. It was like my opinions on that would have been 180 degrees different had any of this been provided to me, but none of it was provided to me while I was head of the World Health Organization, because it doesn't befit specifically the agenda of the United States. Even that's a very interesting one to bring up cursorily because, you know, we make most of the laws that internationally govern what happens with drugs. We do. And the reasons why it's not legal in other countries is because we kind of strong arm them and go, yeah, you know, we don't think you should make that legal. And if you do, we're going to withhold trade from you, and things like that. So it's pretty fascinating to think about that strong arming, much less the strong arming once again of things like cellular phone companies, stuff like that. especially when you bring up things like Edward Snowden and what we found out with PRISM in 2012 and the idea that, like, oh no, absolutely every device you have from your phone to your smartphone to your computer to your laptop to your television screen, to your car. If you are connected to the Bluetooth in your car, man. It's there and it's listening.
Yeah. Your car is a mobile computer that you drive now.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's pretty interesting, you know, to see the infiltration of all that technology. And once creepily, one of the first big conferences that I got paid to work here in Austin was a White Hat hacking conference. And they had a former head of the FBI cybersecurity division speaking as a keynote speaker. This was like 2010, 2011. And he was like, barely the time of Blackberries. Definitely not the time of like flat screen phones like we have now. But he was like, 5 years ago, the FBI could with 85% accuracy predict where you will be in the next 5 minutes. That's anybody in this room. Just with the metadata from your cell phone.
Yeah.
And that was still flip phone era, things like that. So just, and that was, hey, you know, where do you, what Valero do you stop and get coffee at in the morning? You know, what time window are you normally there? That kind of stuff. So when you start looking at the data that we know they swath through programs like PRISM and stuff like that, where it was international phones, it was all kinds of things that were listening to us on a daily basis. And when you start thinking about that in terms of ultrasonic technology, in terms of other technologies that, you know, you may not even think about are there, doctor. One of the things I'm working on right now, and I'm going to put this out there so that people know it's happening, but I am actively working on a video of it. I was with a friend who had a baby monitor going at home, and he was like, hey, check this out. And wife had the baby asleep and was doing the doom scroll in the middle of the night, you know, like you're prone to do, just laying in bed and scrolling. And I want to say she was scrolling Instagram, and literally every minute or so, that phone took a picture of her. And you could see it happen on the, you wouldn't have been able to see it in this view, but in the nighttime view of that baby monitor with the infrared, you could see it plain as day, like a flash of infrared light. Same as if they used a flash on the camera to take a picture. Taking a picture of her face, gathering biometric data of how pleased are you? Things like that. Like, that's how it serves up programmatic advertising, things like that. That's how it's going to, like, are you angry right now? Like, let's give you something to make your brain react in a different way. And these are all things that, man, we opt into in these systems. We opt into these things when we decide to click the checkbox and say, okay, so that we can doom scroll and say hi to a friend across the country every once in a while. You know, or get that serotonin hit of liking something. So it's funny how much we actively consent into so much of this actual experimentation on the public, you know, and programs that, yes, are gathering data and are gathering absolutely your brainwave patterns and the way that you think on a daily basis. Like, this is the reason why we in America have zero actual definition legally of a digital identity. But the UK does. All those annoying checkboxes you see, folks, where it's like, yes, allow my cookies, you know, or allow essential cookies. That's because the UK and Britain and everybody else decided the fact that those are part of your unique identifier online. That's part of you and your identity and how you think. That's a stamp on who you are. We don't see it that way. We see that as data that is there to be gathered and sold. So,
yeah, and as a matter of fact, for the listeners, if you don't believe that, try running your cell phone through a VPN and put yourself in a different location. See how many of your favorite applications and websites let you on.
Yeah, 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 yeah. No, see how many Zero. Of them. Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. They ain't gonna like that too much. And it's interesting when you start exploring that, because at that point, you don't need permission to experiment on the public. They are giving you permission to experiment on them. You know, they can do the same thing, flashing that screen a certain number of times and, you know, electronically changing your brainwave state, all kinds of things when it comes to that kind of technology. So. The idea of ultrasonic control, the idea of being targeted by means outside of implantation, outside of physical contact, is utterly a possibility when it comes to the manipulation of the mind.
Well, and now that basically 5G is everywhere, I mean, not being around a cell signal, it's hard to find that place anymore. You've been to my ranch with me, and up until about a year ago, there was one place that you could get a bar if you absolutely needed to text somebody or make an attempt to get a call out, mostly text because it uses less bandwidth. But there was one place by where we make our fire, our little fire pit there, that you, if you stood just right, you could get a bar. Now, I don't care where you're at on that ranch, you can get a signal. I mean, you've got 3 to 5 bars. Oh, yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. And that's out there. That's out there.
Yeah.
And intentionally so. And you know, that is something, once again, when you start talking about the way that technology affects our everyday life, the way that we are swathed with technology. Whenever you have sent me targeted individuals to work with to help make binaural beats for things like that, that is one of the things I have recommended to them, is as much as possible, get back to grounding, get back to things like that, get back to places where you can be without a cell phone signal if possible. You know, even doing grounding work at home, it's pretty amazing now the grounding blankets you can buy and things like that, that I don't think will absolutely make a stop to things, but will definitely help alleviate some symptomology, you know?
Yeah. You can actually buy sheets, grounding sheets now that, you know, fitted sheet, put it on your bed.
Yep.
Plugs into the grounding hole in the, you know, the electrical outlet. And that's a good way, because I, you know, we certainly, you're probably going to ask it. I'll just ask it to myself right now. What do you do if you find out you're targeted?
That's exactly where I was going.
For one, I tell people, don't stop living. That's what they want you to do. They want you to sit at home and, you know, be on that computer, you know, looking up everything there is about electronic harassment and microchipping. They want you to spend all your money on scams and, you know, trying to look for something that more than likely is not going to be there. But, you know, the best thing you can do is, you know, maybe try to contact with other people that are like-minded. If your family doesn't believe you, don't try to force it, because the more you force it, the crazier you look.
Yep.
You know, and it's not going to be, typically it's not going to be your work, unless you're a licensed person that sits you down in front of a psychiatrist. It's going to be a family member. And they're doing it out of caring. They're not usually doing it because they're part of the conspiracy against you. They're doing it because they don't want to see you on the news shooting up a place or being shot.
That's right.
So that's usually, you know, kind of where they're at. Now, that's come a long way. That used to be really bad. Now, here in the last 5 years, I've had a lot of family members contact me that aren't the targeted individual. Their son, their daughter, their wife, or their husband is. And they've seen our show, or they've heard me someplace else, or they've got information on it. And they've called me and they say, you know what? This is a family member that's never been crazy before. We've heard you talk about this. This seems to be what it is. What do we do? And I tell them, I said, you know, the best thing you can do is still try to live your life, because it's almost like if you can still force yourself to get out there and function. And I know it's hard. You know, I mean, I've seen people, you know, that are being victimized by this, that, you know, they're having their skin burned, they're having lesions put all over their body, they're hearing voices, are being kept up all night. But you got to force through it and try to live life as normally as you can, because when you do that, they eventually get tired of messing with you. If they see that they're not going to be able to degrade your life down to basically causing you to commit suicide, which seems to be the ultimate goal in a lot of these targetings, that they'll usually kind of back off. So, you know, that the most important treatment is just to live your life. You know, the more you sit on the computer and look stuff up about it, kind of the crazier you're going to drive yourself.
Well, and like we've talked about numerous times with not just you, but Dr. Duncan, rest his soul, when we used to have him on regularly a couple few times a year, is that victimized mindset, that lowered brain register in such a way is what they're able to hijack easier. You know, so it's one of those, the more you can be familiar with your inner voice, a good strong inner voice, a good self-identity of who you are, what you stand for, what you believe, and you know, hard moral boundaries that you would not cross that are not you, you know. You need to be familiar with those and intimately familiar with those, because those are the things that it's going to push you to, that the system is kind of made to push you to, because those, whenever you once again fall down that never ending spiral of thought form with that is when you are easier to control.
Yeah. And you're right. I mean, I always tell people, if you have somebody targeting you that's telling you, if you commit this mass shooting, that we'll leave you alone. Well, that's not going to happen. You know, not only are you're probably going to be killed by the police, you know, or you're going to end up killing yourself after you do something like that. So, you know, anybody out there listening that knows somebody that's targeted, or that if you are targeted, don't buy into that. You know, there's nothing no one's going to stop. It's not going to stop if you do something illegal or dastardly or evil.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And once again, understanding that well-developed inner voice and knowing that's not something that you would do or think about doing to begin with. And utterly denying that. Not giving it the consent that is necessary for the system, because it oddly is a consentable system in that kind of way.
And that's what I'll get a lot of questions on that. What's the difference between harassment and control?
Yes.
And I'll tell them, if I put a voice in your head, Chris, that sounds like me, saying, "Oh, I bet you think you're hot with those freaking glasses, man. I bet that new haircut, you think you're really cool." And, you know, well, that, you recognize that as harassment. But if I put similar comments in your head that sound like your voice, that little voice that's in your head when you read a book, and that's the best way to describe it. We all have that. When you're reading something, you're hearing what you read in a little voice in your head. And that's your voice. And if I put that same harassment in your head with your voice, and that can be done, you know, they watch you long enough to where they can actually, you know, grab your voice, voice of relatives, voice of your mother, voice of your father. Don't think just because you're hearing voices and it sounds like your mother that's, you know, harassing you, that they're part of it and it's them doing it. I guarantee you it's not. So, I mean, this technology isn't something that anybody can access. You have to have a clearance to access it. You know, it's not your neighbor, unless your neighbor's former CIA or former FBI, like in my case it was. But it's not going to be your neighbor that works at a grocery store, you know, and it's not going to be your mom and dad that are retirees. You know, it probably isn't the government. It's probably a private contractor that's experimenting on you as part of a government program, but usually not a CIA agent or an NSA agent doing it directly. It's usually someone working as a private investigator in your community that's former FBI, former DOD, and has clearance to actually access this technology.
Yeah. Yeah. And once again, I just popped up an article that came out. I almost sent it to you the other day, and I don't know why I didn't. But I did post it on the group, and that was August 14th. It came out. New brain devices first to read out inner speech. This is a device that basically they are able to textually read what you are thinking, things like that. So yeah, when you start marrying that with the idea of what we've talked about before, e.g. heterodyning and the idea of picking up brain waves at a distance and recording brain waves.
And we've always said, Chris, you and I both, that technology, what the government has access to, and what we usually get around to getting to in the private industry always has a 20 or 30 year lag time. Well, guess what, brother? We've been doing this about 20, at least I have about 20 years with you, probably 10 or so.
At least.
And,
since we met like since Aaron Alexis, man, that began my deep dive into this stuff.
Yeah. Since that's when you were working for the dark side, you know, and,
yeah, no, and that's just it. Like
and now we're to that point where we're seeing the private research kind of catch up to what the government was doing 20 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. And that's to bring this full circle in the last few minutes, Doctor. I think that is where organizations like Targeted Justice, Mind Nexus, people like yourself, other doctors that are involved with this, people doing other research, even myself, we need to get together to see what we can do to refocus this effort. You know, one of the things that we talk about in the remote viewing community regularly and that they talk about, and I think a lot of it is because that was birthed in a lab. You know, and from lab work, but is nomenclature, the idea of, are we all speaking the same language? If a doctor in Spain, who is the Spanish Dr. John Hall in the Azores, is he speaking the same nomenclature and language that you are here, or even across the community? Are we using the same nomenclature, and are we considering the fact of the path of investigation needs to be trod and stepped in the same way, you know, or at least with a concerted effort toward the same goal?
Yeah, I mean, and luckily in the medical field, that for the most part is already true.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. That would be kind of like what I was saying with a parallel track of research for civilian AHI, you know, maybe then trying to piggyback it on something that also deals with UFOs or, you know, I mean, it's.
Well, and that becomes the dangerous part, sadly. Yeah. I love my UFO UAP community. I love my cryptid community and things like that. But too,
I've gotten more into that lately by watching your stuff.
Oh, you know, so. Oh man, out there where you're at, especially with your ranch, bro. But in it, especially with the cryptids.
I don't want to know.
I don't want to know, man.
I don't want to know.
I enjoy my ranch too much. but in all sincerity, it's one of those, it depends on how you come to science, you know, no different than trying to approach a squirrel in the park. If you've got large raving gestures, that squirrel probably ain't going to come anywhere near you. But if you give it a treat it likes and you're calm and you're relaxed, you're really cool with it. And you just spend some time.
I thought you were going to say if you have big nuts.
Well, yeah, that and a roux.
Because squirrels like them.
But the idea is come to science with data that they can use. Something that they can use for their own purposes to begin with. You know, that
can refute.
Yeah.
And can refute. Yeah.
Exactly. Because at that point, you know, if you're a Sasquatch or out in the woods every weekend or every other weekend and you got like cell phone trail cameras and stuff, give those pictures to your local biology department at a university. You know, they could be doing, or even like Texas Parks and Wildlife, let them know that you're taking pictures out there. Help do deer counts. Things like that, wildlife counts, because now you're contributing to science to begin with that they have to write grants for and stuff, you know? So the idea of contributing to them and then asking for their help when something comes along that is anomalous, that you need looked at in a different way, you know? And even we as researchers in this field of targeted individuals and targeting technologies, Dr. Hall, we can take this to other doctors and other people in a different light and get the help that we need for experiencers and for those that are targeted in that kind of way.
No, that's kind of been the goal, at least my goal here in the last few years.
Yeah.
You know, and I know I've got a third book that I've been trying to get out that, you know, between raising my daughter and, you know, fighting in court, you know, for those that don't know, I do anesthesia and pain management. A lot of it's personal injury. So, you know, I spend as many hours in front of lawyers and judges as I do in the clinic, you know, for a lot of those clients. So, there is a third book coming that's going to address some of that, you know, too. But, you know, I know that's what Chris and I were talking off camera beforehand. And, you know, it's time that we kind of try to break this into more into the mainstream scientific track that the government was forced to go down because they had their own people come voicing these complaints.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's kind of the way to take advantage of it, I think.
Well, and as we've said numerous times, as we've closed our episodes for the last many, many years, Dr. Hall, it's the idea of the only way to fix this. So much like capital D disclosure with UFOs, UAPs, like that can only come through a legal means. We can only hold alphabet agencies or contractors thereof responsible through illegal means, you know? So, if there has been a protocol set up for anomalous health incidents inside of these medical systems, things like that, then yes, we need to leverage that. We need to try to use that. We need to try and at least get as many TIs as possible to try to talk to their doctors about it, to at least begin that level of trust. Because once again, even with UFOs, UAPs, like you eventually got to trust NASA. You got to trust the NASA panel, you know? You can't just call up and threaten them and then wonder why they don't want to help you, you know?
Well, and I'll tell you right now, I mean, now that it's on TRICARE, if you're a targeted individual and you're a military dependent and you're on TRICARE, you know, that might, you know, be an option for you right now. I mean, if you look up that website, they tell you exactly how to go about making the complaint. So,
yeah. And I mean, the symptoms are listed there, things like that. I would say much like any medication you see on TV where it's like, hey, you know, talk to your doctor about it. Like, go visit this website, folks. It is quite literally tricare.mil. Tricare.mil. And when you get there, go to the search for AHI or just Google anomalous health incidents, TRICARE, and this page will pop up.
Well, and interestingly enough, they also state on that page that it's not necessarily a medical problem. It's a counterintelligence problem. They state that on the page. So, or it's either on that page or on the DHA 244 form, but it is stated that it's a counterintelligence issue. So, I mean, they're trying to be honest, I think.
Well, and that's just it. That's just it. And I mean, even here, what are the treatment options? Audiology, behavioral health, neurology, physical therapy, primary care. So art, music. All kinds of things. So yeah, I think it's the fact of once again, much like Aero and that kind of stuff, I think it is a good foot forward. And I think it is a great, great field of hope, for sufferers out there of this, that at least there are medical means coming about. Because if it can start with the military, then it can move forward to others, you know? So I'm very happy to hear this. I was honestly like hugely energized whenever you sent me the information earlier about this and mentioned it before the show. I was like, this is awesome. Like this is a whole new light at the end of the tunnel.
I sent it to you, brother, because I wanted it in the vault in case it disappears.
Oh, it's going in the vault. And on the external hard drive that hides around. Dr. Hall, thank you so much, as always, for your time. I greatly appreciate it, especially on this auspicious 200th episode. It's so great. You've been such a good friend of the show since literally right at the beginning, man. So thank you.
It's always a joy to be on here. And you reach so many people. And for those of you that are watching and listening, I'm going to tell you right now, you don't know how many times that Chris has actually called me almost in tears over messages and, you know, that he gets emails that he gets from people that are watching his show that are targeted. So, I mean, he's not only passionate about what he does, he's compassionate about the people that are being affected. So it's a lifestyle for him. It's not just a show.
That's just it. This is one of the few causes that this show has, along with like human trafficking awareness, things like that, where these are things that sadly not enough people want to talk about. They're nebulous, very nebulous, very dark concepts that expose a very seedy underbelly to a lot of things, and it can be a little disturbing sometimes to chat about it in such a casual way, you know. So thank you for always being there for the trauma, Doctor.
Oh man, thank you for always inviting me.
Absolutely. Hold the line real quick while we close things out. As always, while you are online, well, but let everybody know where they can go to buy your books. Of course.
Well, still Amazon.com, Barnes and Nobles, anywhere that sells books.
Absolutely.
Guinea Pigs, Technologies of Control.
Yep. Yep. Exactly. And, you know, you can always stop on by CuriousRealm.com/store, folks. Curious Realm is where you can like, follow, subscribe. /store is where you can find the store, where you can find all of the books, including those by Dr. John Hall, as well as Dr. Robert Duncan, right there on the store. While you're online, make sure to stop on by Curious Research. Curious Research is, of course, our endeavor to help bridge the worlds of the scientific and paranormal topics. If you are an experiencer, stop on by and fill out our report form. We also have the new Experiencer Support Network that we have started. We have written protocols for an AA style group, completely anonymous, no politics, no religious base or anything like that. Just a mutual place for people to be able to meet, talk without judgment. The protocols are there for you to be able to go and start your own local group of awakening together. You can find that at curiousresearch.org/support. Thank you, as always, everybody, for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.